episode of We Talk Comics. It is episode number 171. This is called Vic's Reading List. I am the Crown Prince of Charisma, Mo. I have with me the Chief Defender of the Faith, Mr. Brett Podcast.
Mr. Brett Podcast, yes. Still defending the faith.
Yes, Brett. Brett, explain why you're now Mr. Brett Podcast. That's your new name.
Well, we receive so many emails from people who really want to be on the show and get us to review their product. And one of my favorite recent ones wrote to me as Mr. Brett Podcast. It was just, I thought to myself, now that's a last name. There.
That is it. That is your. If you don't legally change it to that, I'm gonna be so damn disappointed. It's unbelievable. Chris.
Yeah, but
Chris,
where did he get the Mr. part?
I don't know. The guy said. That's what the guy sent. Brett forwarded me the email. I'm like, this is fantastic. All right, we have you, Chris. You are the man with no nickname, and we're moving on from you already. No offense.
Good with me. Let's get to the meat of this.
He is vivacious and curvaceous, victorious and glorious, venerable and vulnerable. I don't know what the hell. His name starts with a V, so I'm using a lot of that. His name is Vic Maholtra. He's the artist on such books as Thumbprints, Roche Limit, and I'll suddenly escape my mind your current book here.
The Killer Inside Me. And
The Killer Inside Me from IDW.
X-File stuff and Tiger Lawyer, which is some of your favorite stuff.
Oh, it's about a dude. It's about a tiger. Get this. This is a tiger. It's also a lawyer. It's a tiger lawyer. Did you know that?
No, I don't if you've ever read the book. You just like the show.
I've read that just like I've read Cerebus. inside joke for those of you. Okay. But Vic, Brett invited you on. Brett, why don't you take over here?
Well, I really thought to myself, I was thinking to myself, and I thought, you know, we haven't really talked to Vic on the show proper. I mean, Vic, you've been on the We Talk Comics Live that one time, but we never really sat down and chatted with you. And I thought, you know, we always chat about people's work, but it would be way more fun if we chatted about things that influence them and things that they really enjoy. So that was kind of what I put to you, is to give us your favorite works. We could read them, and then we could just basically sit and talk about your favorite work and you know, why it's your favorite and how it influenced you.
I love that idea. You know, doing interviews about your own work, podcast or written, is they're pretty good. It's good to do the promotional stuff, but you just, I don't know, it's hard to talk about your own work like that. And I think that's the case for a lot of creators, and it's more fun talking about comics that you really love. So yeah, I love the idea.
Well, and the thing is, in so many cases, like, unless you're talking to somebody who's had like a 40-year career in the industry, it's hard to not, you know, continuously rehash the same questions over and over again. And you know, really, that's not what we like to do. We want to be able to kind of find the new ground. And I think this is a great way to do it. And there's no question that I've read some stuff here that I hadn't read before. And you know, it's definitely exposed me to different stuff. So for that, I'm happy.
Awesome. So should we go over the material, or?
Yes, that seems a fantastic idea. All right. So let's see. Well, we had Paul Pope, 100%. We had The Winter Men, and that's, what is that, Brett Smith?
Brett Lewis and John Paul Leon.
Yep. And then, of course, Wolverine Revolver, which will definitely, Victor Gishler and Das Pastoris. And let's see now. So we have Jason's Left Bank Gang. We have, of course, I've got too many piles here.
Marvel Fanfare number 40.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Last Man, Volume 1 by Balak Sandleville and Vivas. I'm sure I'm butchering the names in some way, shape, or form. And then if we have time to touch on it, then we have City of Glass, which is by Mazzucchelli and
Batman Year One.
Paul Karasik and Batman Year One, yes.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
That's good. We're totally getting there. There's a lot.
And Mazzucchelli also did on Marvel Fanfare, that Marvel Fanfare 40. I think it's the first story we're really going to concentrate on, right? Written by Amy Sankey and art by Mazzucchelli.
Yeah, I forgot there was a second story in here. That's right. I've never read the second story.
That's funny.
I did. I didn't know for sure where it was coming up, so I did. It's not bad. It's pretty good. It's the Andrew Sankey Mazzucchelli.
All right, so which one should we start with? Why don't we start with 100% by Paul Pope? So, Vic, what made you go with this one?
I'm a big fan of, I would say, almost all of Paul Pope's stuff. I feel like he brings like this different vibe to his comics because he writes them and draws them, and the pacing is so unique. And, you know, it's slower. There's lots of build up to the scenes. And this book specifically is very cool because it has like I think there's like three or four different narratives that are kind of crisscrossing and then end up connecting in ways. But it's also not your typical comic. Like, I like to recommend this to people that don't like superhero comics and they're not sure what's out there. And I think this is a pretty cool kind of a science fiction, futuristic romance story. That takes place in some sort of strip club. That's not a strip club.
I think it would be well nigh impossible to try to explain what kind of club that actually was to somebody who hadn't read the book, because we're talking about in-depth detail there.
Oh, it made me squirmy, really uncomfortable just even thinking about some of the ideas presented there. Just in the idea of the strip club, it was gross.
No, I thought it was hot. I was so turned on.
No, you know what? I didn't. I mean, you get this book, and the first issue, very early on, there's a murder. Like, that's kind of how it's introduced.
Yeah.
So you think you're in line for this murder mystery, and I didn't understand what this was. It's a 5-issue miniseries. It was somewhere early on in issue number 3. That I picked up what it was and that it wasn't. Because it says, oh, the guy is caught. And you're always assuming that he's not caught and it's going to be revealed as a different character. And it isn't. This it takes place in the future. But it's a slice of life storyline that really shows that people are the same everywhere and every time period. And once I got that and was able to just enjoy the characterization and the relatability still of these characters and their situations, despite the totally different setting. I really love this. It's like he gives you this at the beginning going, come on guys, this is what it is. And then it's just to screw with you. Just like, you know, the murder mystery. You're like, what is this ever going to come up again? It never does.
It kind of goes against, like the current kind of model of storytelling, which is like, you know, if you pitch a book to a publisher, you do the 5 or 6 or 8 page beginning sequence that, you know, it starts everything off with action, but it really tells you what's going to happen in this whole series, whether it's a miniseries or something that's ongoing. And here it's just like, here's this intriguing beginning, but we're just going to go completely away from it. And it's not even important by the end of it.
That's really brave of him to do it that way, I thought.
He's such an interesting creator. Like, he's one of those guys who really doesn't try to follow trends. He doesn't try to, you know, be something that he's not. He just completely accepts what he is, and he completely puts all of himself into his work. And I think that, you know, like, it's so, like, there's so much to 100%. And really all of his work, because after I read this, I kind of got interested, and so I started reading some of his other stuff, because, you know, thematically it's not necessarily the same, but very much it has the same feel, and I know that sounds a little odd, but it's just because of his art, it's so stylistic, but so Paul Pope, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I was the same way. Almost all of his books, it can find some sort of value to me anyway. But here, just in case, so some people that are listening don't know about a few of the stories without spoiling too much of it, hopefully. I don't know. Yeah, the strip club's not really a strip club. It's like society's gone beyond that factor being exciting to people. So now it's like the dancers put devices inside of them that show holograms or 3D holograms of their insides, and that's what gets people excited. And actually, I really love the I don't remember his name now, but the dude with the teapots.
Oh, well, yes. That was cool. I like the teapots.
And his mission of, like, his art mission of, you know, hitting those notes and all that. That's really cool.
No, wasn't it, weren't they all tuned to C?
Yeah, one note symphony.
One note, yeah. I really like that part.
So are you, when you're reading this, or is it just like do you read it and look at it just as like an artist and what you can take from Paul Pope, or are you kind of like, you know, just enjoying the storyline and just getting that? Like, how do you view it?
Yeah, I would say like all of these choices for today are comics that I just loved overall. Like, I got wrapped up into the story and just read the whole thing, but they're also good for me to go back to and then pick apart art-wise as well. There are books that I pick up and I'm like, yeah, I don't dig this story at all. I don't like the pacing. I don't like, you know, the choices, but the art's really nice. And those ones, I'll look at the art. But yeah, all these ones, at first, you know, just I like this person's work enough to look at it. And then you just read it and you get lost in it and then look at it over and over.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one. So thanks for that one, Vic. Because it's strange. I don't know if it's one that I would recommend to people, because it is, you know, like you know, it's like it's not what, like, I don't know how much of a gateway book it is, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
On the other
hand,
it's also good that you're right. Like, it totally breaks away from the idea of here's what comic books are. If they have a preconceived notion. So it's really interesting piece of work.
See, I'd go with one trick ripoff or something like that rather than this 100%. But maybe that's because I like my Paul Pope in shorter doses.
I think it's one of those things that it's great for if somebody has kind of been reading comic books, they understand the medium, but they're maybe getting bored of it. This is a kick in the pants, you know, to the standard comics.
Yeah, maybe it's a bit, it jumps around a bit, but I think, yeah, maybe it's a little tough for brand new readers, but I think there's, like, I just love the dialogue. Like, he spends a lot of time just sitting in scenes, and the conversations, they're kind of like these abstract conversations about the, you know, the dialogue's really cool. And I don't know, it's an interesting, I don't know, I just like being in some of these scenes, like when the busboy and that new girl who started at the club, when they go out on their first date, and it's like just the conversations they have, and it's cool because they go through some
story.
Yeah, like the fairy tale aspect of some of those stories. Pretty cool.
And it's natural to all those characters. Like, that's the thing I think that maybe shocked me more, is that all of those characters, everything they say, feels completely natural to them. You know, he does a very good job of the dialogue.
Yeah, and then artistically, I would say the way that he uses the sound effects is very effective. I've seen it in a few other places over the years, like, just having like the boom, 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 like of the music in the club, just like pasted over the top of the pages, just over and over, it really sells the atmosphere. And one of the things you'll see in some of the books, well, probably Last Man, is just like slowing the pacing down. And in here, there's a few scenes when they're having sushi, and it shows a process of like breaking apart the chopsticks and cleaning them off, and just kind of like the simple fun things you can do with comics when you're breaking up like little actions rather than, you know, here's one establishing shot and that's all you're going to get for setting the scene. He'll like take up a whole page or multiple panels to do that. And to me as a reader, I really enjoy that sort of stuff.
Awesome. Well, why don't we talk about Last Man? You know, the number one thing that annoyed me about Last Man was that I really want to read more after the first one. Because the story didn't end, because I'm expecting with 200 pages, I'm expecting the story to kind of have some level of wrap-up. And then it's just like, wait, you mean I don't even get to see the end of the tournament? Holy crap.
Yeah, because of you, they just got $50 four times over, three times over. So they should give you a little cutback there, because, I mean, I know I got to buy the rest, because, yeah, this was awesome.
Yeah, you can breeze through this. I was really surprised when I first read it. I guess it's like, it takes a lot from manga, so you can just, like, I picked it up and started reading it. My wife was beside me, and I was like, hey, let's read this together. So we read through it. We were, like, 70 pages through it, and in like 40 minutes, 30 minutes, but it was hard to stop reading. I don't know if you guys found that as well.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I read it at one go.
Yeah. I think I may have read the entire thing in 40 minutes. It was just, you know, picked it up and I'm going, you know, and I think, you know, cause one of the interesting things for me about it is that the action flows so well from panel to panel and page to page. So there's a real nice organic motion to the whole thing.
Yeah, the paneling really pushes you forward, and there's not like a whole lot of dialogue in it, but there's more than that to the storytelling. It's not like there's just enough to keep you moving forward, and the drawings are great too. I noted a few pages up here. I don't know if you guys have the book in front of you. But if any readers do, there's, like I was talking about with 100%, where you take, you know, a page or two to set the scene. On page 16, there's a sequence like that. And this is the day, like, where the tournament's beginning. And it just has, like, these fireworks and then people, like, I assume in a parade, walking through the city and then a few warm-ups and just stuff like that. And I really love how he introduces the main characters.
It's a wonderful job of pacing and a wonderful job of characterization, giving you just enough of the characters so you know the characters without giving you too much so that you're intrigued to learn more. And that's one of the things I like the most about it. Especially the you know, Richard, what is it, Aldana?
Yeah.
Yeah, as the stranger, basically. And, you know, it took me probably, again, about 15, 20 pages to kind of get into it because, and that's one thing, Vic, I don't know where you get your books from, but, like, they're not, you know, they're one of the things I appreciated was they're all different. Like, this is different. So, I mean, the one I'm reading right before this is, and then I get to, like, Winterman, and then I get to this, and right? So that's a like, a hard left turn. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A completely different book and completely different everything. So it takes me a little bit to get into it. And then once I got onto it, like I couldn't put it down, and I finished it. And I read it on my Kindle app, actually, on my phone or on a tablet. And I read it that way, and I'm like, immediately, like, and here's the rest you can buy. And I'm like, well, there's some money out my pocket there.
Yeah, it's so tempting, you know, to buy it immediately afterwards. I'm like, okay, I need to know.
You know the reason why I didn't buy it? Because I would have missed the podcast. Like, I'm not kidding, because I read this tonight. This is the one book I saved till tonight. So, I mean, I started reading this. I'm like, if I had bought these, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. I'd still be reading these. I'd be like, God, the guys are talking, but I just can't put it down.
Yeah, this one is cool. I was in Paris, and there was this it's like it's a little local, very, I don't want to use independent, but I guess that's probably the best term, convention there called We Do BD. And because, you know, Band-Aid Destiny, like their word for the comics, right? So BD. And these guys were there, the authors. They had a little panel. It was really cool. They showed a trailer for the anime version that I think they're kickstarting now. Mm. But it looks so cool as well. But I think I had heard about the book prior to that, but I hadn't read it. But I heard of the hype about it. So when I finally checked it out, I was really blown away by the action and the comedy. There's some hilarious scenes here, like near the end where the kid's teacher goes and... Am I allowed to put spoilers in this conversation?
Yeah, what the hell?
I think that's fair.
Yes. I think
hopefully
I think,
people have read the book, right?
And even if they don't, you know, I don't think it's going to be a big enough spoiler to make anybody not want to read a terrific book like this.
Yeah, that's true.
I can't imagine, so.
Yeah, so where he goes and declares his love for the main kid's mom, it's so comedic, and his expressions are so over the top. It's so pathetic. I just can't help but laugh and feel sorry.
Actually, you know, it's funny because that moment reminded me so much of Asterix. You know, it reminded me of Mo. Help me out here. What's the name of the bard?
Cacophonics.
Yes, Cacophonics. You know, he just has that same kind of mustache element going on, and just those same like please.
No, I felt for the character. I actually didn't think it was funny. I thought it was heart-wrenching.
Well, I thought it was embarrassing.
Yes, yes.
You have no soul, man.
It's a Three's Company moment.
Like I was like, this poor guy. Like, on the other hand, I thought it was a little creepy. And I'm like, yeah, any guy who does this, the woman better run. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was actually kind of heart-wrenching. So maybe I'll go back and read that one again. But
maybe it's in retrospect, but I you know, I read this a while ago now, but I think when I was reading it, you know, this, it's already there. Everything's printed. You can't change what's happening. I was just like, don't do this. What you're doing is so wrong to this fellow here. Cause I was like, you're just ruining all of your chances. But, yeah, I was very surprised. I mean, the whole book has a good mix of comedy and action and really effective when they use like a full page for like a big punch to someone's face or something like that. It's cartooned just perfectly. I don't think there's a common thread between all these books, but one might be that the stuff's not overworked. None of the art's overworked for the most part in all these books, which I really like. It's very natural. It's not perfect, but it's effective.
Well, this book is actually quite different than the rest that you suggested to us. The rest of the books you gave us have these small little Ditko-esque panels and tons of dialogue. This completely different. Do you read a lot of manga and stuff in this style? Or?
I do. I'm a big fan of manga. I just didn't, for the purposes of this podcast, I mostly avoided recommending those because those are like 10 volume things. But some that I have around me are like, I have like Pluto and 20th Century Boys. It's by Naoki Urasawa.
But 20th Century Boys, man, that there's a lot of reading in that too.
That's true.
You seem to like words, which is, I do as well, but I was surprised by this book because it's so different than everything else.
I think some of the stuff's interesting. Yeah, some of it's pretty wordy. Being a comic artist, it's interesting looking at stuff that has lots of captions and balloons and stuff that doesn't. And you know, reading it's one thing, but when you're designing a page. And you're factoring in the script, and you just see a page with like a lot of balloons and captions. You start looking for examples of how other people accomplish the same goal of getting those things down and moving the eye and keeping it not looking too crazy. So some of the stuff is research material as well, even though it's wordy.
No, I just the rest of the books have a very noir feel to them, and this one didn't. And your own work as well, I always find it has a noir type feel to it. So
I can't escape that.
Well, no, I mean, your lighting is spectacular. So
yeah, it's not a bad thing. And but that's it. This is a French. Some of my favorite books I've read over the last several years have been books from Belgium or France, and French language books like Promethea and The Killer and things like that. And I just think that like it's really cool because it's definitely it has a French feel, but it also has it's a French manga. Like it has a French feel and also has a Japanese film feel, and it's a very nice melding. And for me, maybe my favorite, this 100% could very well be the favorite things that you gave me.
Cool.
So we get them out of the way right away, but let's move on to another one, Brent.
Sure. Well, why don't we, let's see now, it's a tough call, but let's go back to the denser side. Let's go to the Wintermen then. This is an odd story anyways, because I remember collecting this actually when it first came out, and it said it was an 8-issue miniseries, and then it was I think then it became a 6-issue miniseries, and then it wound up being what is it, five and a special
extra long special. Yeah, and I do think that hurt the pacing of the book a little bit. Like
seemed to me,
yeah, definitely. So I mean, you can't really blame them for that. I mean, I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but I do think that hurt the pacing of it a little bit. But yeah, this is. What is it about this book that you appreciate so much, Vic?
This is like an early. This blew my mind when it came out as a single issue and finally concluded. And like, I take a lot of influence from the art in this book, but from J.P. Leone
and
overall.
He's amazing. He's
yeah.
He's fantastic.
There's other people that draw like him, but they don't compose their panels the same way, so sometimes they draw with this kind of bold, thick, shadowy style, and it just doesn't have the same oomph to me anyway. But yeah, this one has a really twisted history because yeah, I think it was supposed to be through Vertigo originally and then got shifted over to Wildstorm, and yeah, all the delays. I think it took like 3 or 4 years for 5 of the issues to come out, and then the 6th issue came out like a year or two later. So yeah. Really convoluted, and I know there's a history behind that because the writer Brent Lewis had an injury that kind of took him out for a while. It's an interesting story. I don't know if I should get into that, but yeah, this is a really cool book. It is a noir book, definitely. It's framed with some superhero stuff. Intertwined, and right from the start, you know that because I think, yeah, is it the first page? Yeah, the very first page of the book is kind of that, you know, the Superman-esque Russian superhero lifting a tank over his head, and it's like it's very much like the propaganda of the time with all this bold lettering pasted all over the page.
But it disappears almost immediately, and it isn't until like issue 3 or 4, I think, of the. It comes back up, and by that point, I was, oh, yeah, I forgot superheroes.
Yeah, I've heard that as a criticism of the book because people actually loved just the crime part because they do it so well. So it seems very well researched. And I'm such a big fan of this book. Used to like buy it, find it at conventions, and just give it out to other artists or writers, like friends. Just trying to spread the word because I know it was like a kind of like a small book really and didn't get much exposure. But the one issue I love is chapter 4, which is titled Citizen Soldiers. And that's the one, it's like a day in the life of Nikki and Chris as they start off in McDonald's eating, what are they eating? Like, fries and Big Macs and playing chess, and then it goes off on this whole kind of weird one day in their life trip that's hilarious but also kind of touching in a way, but also odd at the very end.
Yeah, it's I have to admit that the overall series didn't work for me quite so much, but that issue is seriously one of the best things ever I read. Like, it was just, because it was, nobody does that. Everything's at such a pace that's like such a realistic pace, and everything's from the dialogue and the art and to completely, and you know, and as you kind of see where it's gonna end, you're almost dreading, because you see the ending coming of that issue, and here I am trying to avoid spoilers. You're almost dreading it. It gives you that feel, that uncomfortable feel that I just thought, yeah, like I say, I'm not some of the rest of the series I have some issues with, but this particular issue, like, I think that was one of the best single issues I can ever recall reading.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
And you don't even need to read the whole, you know, the whole story just to read that issue.
It's true.
You could easily just pull that out and read it.
Yeah, I think so. I've read this issue. I've read this whole thing many, many times, and I've gone through it just to, like, you know, study the art. The art's like, it's amazing. The colors are great too. Dave Stewart, as always, does amazing work. But yeah, you're right. There's a pacing issue here, and mostly just because we had to condense it, I assume, because that winter special.
Well, there's where all the superheroes are just in your face.
Yeah. It's so compacted. And this is like the one you look at when you want to see how people accomplish putting like 20 captions and word balloons on a page and still have art visible. Like, that's the issue you want to look at if you were ever faced with that as an artist. But yeah, you can actually tell like that Jean-Paul Leon drew this issue much later than he drew the first issues, because the first issues have this roughness to the line and more abstract, open, negative space. And then by this issue, which is a few years later, everything's a little smoother. And I guess he had to draw smaller panels just because the storytelling needed to each page needed to get more done. But, yeah, it's just interesting seeing the evolution over one book like that.
Now, I had a little trouble getting into the first issue of this. It wasn't until midway through issue two that I really glommed onto this series. Do you guys think it would have done better or been more effective over at Vertigo rather than at Wildstorm? Because I think part of my problem was preconceived notions of what a Wildstorm book is.
Oh, I personally... I mean, I got rid of those years ago because Wildstorm was doing stuff, different stuff by the 2000s. So I wasn't.
Yeah, by the end, that was their intention, was almost being another Vertigo in that regard. The reason why I think this would have been more successful in Vertigo, because I actually think they would have been able to get all of the issues out that they wanted to print and how they wanted to print them, because I think Vertigo just had, you know, more credit in that regard, and it probably would have allowed the sales to be enough to get them through that. If, you know, of course, you know, injuries and all that stuff.
Yeah, there's so many, like you say, there is a, now I do want to know about the history of the book.
Yeah, if you look into the writer Brett Lewis, he's got some interesting podcasts out there where he goes through, you know, what happened during this, and I don't think it was like, I don't feel like it was a happy relationship while they created the book. I think there's a lot of quality within it either way. But yeah, like the story, and he said it in a podcast, so I think it's okay to repeat here now. And I think I've read it in interviews as well, but he was like, he was bottled in a bar with like a Grey Goose bottle that's pretty thick. And he was in a coma for a while. And that was like during working on the book. So there's not much you can do for some of the delays when you factor that in. Mm-hmm. But I think there is more to it than that. But to me, still, there's a lot for this book that I find very interesting. And these are both two creators that I still follow. Brett doesn't have a whole lot of work. He doesn't put out a whole lot of comic stuff. he had a story in one of those Vertigo specials. You know how they put those specials out like once or twice a year?
Yeah, yeah, right. The like quarterly big ones or whatever they are.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So he had a story with Cliff Chang in The Witching Hour. I think that was the one. Maybe 2 years ago. That one is nominated for an Eisner, actually. It's a really good story. It's like 6 or 8 pages, but it's awesome. It's a good story. And it reminds me of Winterman, not at all in like the setup, but the dialogue. His writing has a very specific point of view, I guess.
Well, the best thing for me overall about this book, like as a whole series, was what an incredible job they did of giving me a feeling like we were in a, you know, post, you know, post in a modern day Russia of what we see the idea of what it is, you know, the idea of this world of, for the average citizen where it's, you know, toilet paper is a luxury, and just this world and giving it that feel was like an incredible job doing that. I thought,
I feel like I need to read this book on like in its entirety on like a really busy bus going for like a you know 2-hour drive kind of thing. It was just something to put me in the exact right mood to be in, you know, in that headspace. It would be
well, it's a little else. Depressing. It's a little depressing.
Oh, it is. It is, absolutely. There's no doubt about
yeah,
that.
It is. Yeah, the message at the end is kind of like that. But I remember reading it for the first time, and it's like, it's definitely not a book you can go through and just like tear through it.
No,
it's like you gotta read this in chunks, just because it's like, it's dense. It's a dense book.
And I think absolutely, it's almost one of those cases where I think I should read it again, because I guarantee there's a bunch of stuff that I missed the first time around.
Well, and you know what, I have to say, Chris asked us, he said, it seems like there's 6 issues. So the first issue says 8. Is there more I'm supposed to have? And I was like, no, but trust me, by the time you finish reading it, you'll feel like it was at least 8. it is a dense read.
Yeah, they definitely
put on Brett here.
Yes.
Honestly, I just thought you were whining that you had to read more books.
Well, when am I going to get around to reading Cerebus if I have to?
That's anyway. Right. All right. Well, let's move on to the next bigger one here. Jason's Left Bank Gang. This one I found really odd, because there's moments where I'm like, this is absolutely brilliant, and then there's moments where suddenly it turns into an entirely different story, and it was like, oh, that's weird. I thought maybe
I was too stupid for this book. I thought maybe it's just for people much smarter than I am.
I mean, because, again, here's one of those cases where you've got art, which is, I mean, the colors are beautiful.
Yeah.
That's one thing that struck me immediately with this. But, I mean, but the characters, I mean, of course, they're so similar looking in their animalistic ways and anthropomorphic. And but
three times fast, Brett, say
but you know, the dialogue is incredible. Like, if there's one comic in here where I just think about the dialogue and just people talking and having like random conversations, this one absolutely is that book. It's, you know, some of the dialogue's just fantastic.
What's not to love? Sorry, Brett and Mo, have you guys read Jason before?
This is my introduction to Jason, personally. Yeah.
Okay, my one thought was, why this book?
Mm.
Because I've read a bunch of Jason. I have to admit, the Left Bank Gang is not one of my favorites. I think it's just because I'm way too familiar with some of the source material he's ripped stuff off from. In this,
off is not the right word.
Okay, homaged. Is that okay? I mean, that's great artist steal. It's okay. I love Jason. I love a bunch of his work, but he homages Rafifi and the killing in this, and I mean the entire plot of the robbery is taken from Stanford Kubrick's the killing, although it's not terribly original. Even there, But they're, say, I Killed Adolf Hitler or The Last Musketeer, I think would be a much more better example of Jason's work.
I find I like a lot of his work, and I think it's hilarious actually. But this book, I love the characters. I love that they're all in Paris. They're writers, but in this comic world, Hemingway and Joyce, they draw comic books. They're sitting at their desk struggling through trying to do that. And I don't know. I just love the overall setup. If you're familiar with his work, you already know that what you are introduced to is going to get totally flipped on its ear, and you're going to be served with something that's kind of like, wacky in a way, maybe. And, but if you're not, I always thought that was a cool little twist, but you can kind of expect it coming. But I don't know why I chose this one, but it is, I just wanted to get some Jason in the conversation because I love his work, from his writing to, you know, his influences, but also the art. And yeah, the colors are gorgeous.
Well, I mean, that's it. I mean, if the art is so simple, so from your, like, because I mean, I'm reading this and, okay, here's my experience reading this fic. I don't know what to expect, but I've heard about Jason, so I go in fairly high expectations. And I'm reading it, and I'm not getting it too much. And then all of a sudden I went, hey, let's just treat every page like it's a daily comic book strip. And once I started doing that, I started enjoying it. And then all of a sudden the bank heist happens, and I put it down at the end, and I go, huh? So, like, what is it? When you're talking about art that's so simplistic, so from your – and it is in a lot of ways, right? And there's very little background detail. There's very little – all the characters have the same faces. So it is about the pacing, the storytelling, the panels, and the way it's used. And that stuff I appreciated. But as an artist who knows a hell of a lot more about art than me, like, what is it about something that appears so simple on the surface that – to an outsider like me, because like I say, I had a thought when I'm reading this. I go, okay, this is made for comic book artists and maybe some writers, and not for the rest of us. And so there's like 500 people in the world who are going to be like, this is the greatest book I've ever read. And the rest of us are going to go, huh? Like, but anyway, so those are my thoughts on it. That's my experience. But I'm super curious as to what it is about this that you go, that makes someone who's such a damn fine artist like you are, and whereas I can't draw a stick man, you look at this and go, this is really good art. What is it that appeals to you?
To me, the simplicity is perfect. It's like the lines, I don't know, maybe not every artist like this, but I can look at, like, if I see something that I like, I can look at each individual line and love that line almost, just if it has character to it. And I think all of his individual lines have character to them. But his composition's really strong. You're right, there's not like an overflow of background information, but there's just enough to suggest what's happening with that they're standing in front of a building. There's a lamppost back there. There's a bench over here. So he draws the things that he needs to do, you know, kind of in a similar way, but without the shadows of, you know, something that Mignola might do, very shape-based. So when you look at, like, the pants, they'll have a very specific shape to them that I find appealing. And I've seen some of his books are in black and white. Those are nice as well, but I think the colors really push it forward even more, so they work really well with the inks, but yeah, there's just something about it. I just love work like that. It's, you know, to me, it's part Hergé, and then I still see some Mignola in his work, even though I don't know how old he is. He's probably the same age as Mignola.
Hergé, that's the Tintin you're mentioning, is it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and I love Tintin. I love that art, you know, and yeah. So that's okay. That's interesting. Okay, now I can kind of go back and look at it and kind of look for those things and kind of see part of, I think, what I might have been missing, because I'm, yeah, I like, It's again, it's not a normal narrative, which is, and I don't know, again, he's Norwegian, isn't he, Jason?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I don't know, this book is it translated or did he do it himself or kind of?
No, it's translated, but I think the translations are really good. Who would have done these translations? I don't have the book in front of me, but I think it's Kim Thompson. Fantagraphics. He was personally doing the translations for the Jason books up until he passed away. But I think it's a good translation. It reads pretty good to me. And yeah, definitely look at it again. You'll see the Tintin influences there for sure. It'll look a bit different because the panels are slightly larger than what you usually see in a Tintin book, but they're not as busy either, to be honest. But yeah, that's kind of what I dig about it. I would recommend The Last Musketeer, though, like Chris was saying, because that one's really good as well. But if I remember correctly, maybe I'm thinking something different. I thought that one had a few different stories mixed in it, because he has some stuff that has like this autobiographical feel to it, where it's the same characters, like the anthropomorphic cats or dogs or whatever, but it's like it's him, Jason, as a character. And it has to do with like art. Maybe that's why I appreciate it. It has to do with like going to signings and being late to signings and getting mad at people that criticize your work, or maybe you don't want to look at their portfolios and you pull out a knife or something like that. There's just so funny stuff in his work.
I'd love to help you out there, but I'd have to download it to check because I can't remember. I just remember the main story. Oh, and thanks, Mo, for mentioning Tintin. I was really having some trouble there because I didn't see any Hellboy in Jason whatsoever.
I kind of get it in the bank scenes. I'm like, okay, if I think back on those kind of nighttime scenes and the use of shadows and the different things, I kind of see what Vic's saying there.
Yeah, there's definitely not as much shadow. You're not going to see all the shadows of Mignola's work here. But I see something there. And I used to read he had a blog where he used to go into like, and you're talking about how he's like it ripping off from like these old movies, and his blog was that, where he'd talk about all the old movies that he'd be watching and looking at for influence and digging and talking about them, and he'd post up other stuff. And I think from the blog I got the idea that he was a big fan of the Hellboy stuff. I don't know if it was because he had a sketch on there or maybe just mentioned it. I don't remember how, but that's how I put that together.
Well, let's go on to another one, Brett. What else are we going to talk about here?
All right. Well, why don't we touch on The Wolverine Revolver then by Gishler and Pastoris.
this is the weirdest cover ever, though, right?
Oh, yeah. There is no doubt about that because, I mean, besides the incredibly stylized Wolverine, the fact that you get the character in behind, and it's just one of those moments where you look at it and it feels nothing at all like the story that's inside the book. Even though, you know, both of those characters are in the book, but this was not the story that I was expecting in the least. Like, when I got into it, you know, you're reading it, and it's just like, okay, I get it. It's like, it's cool Wolverine story. And then the very end, what happens, and you're like, whoa, wait a minute, why did that happen? But yeah, that, I mean, the monster character looks really good, you know, and you can definitely, like, it's really good color. And for me, this is shocking for a Marvel book in that regard.
Yeah. This is wild. I don't remember when I first read this or picked it up, but maybe I'd seen some stuff online and I saw some of these interior pages with the monster and Wolverine slicing his arm off and stuff. And I was like, whoa, this is pretty badass stuff. It's almost like heavy metal, like an issue of heavy metal, but a Wolverine story. The art is like painted. It's got European influence to it for sure. And yeah, the cover, you always see this cover showing up when there's stuff online about worst covers ever. This is like one of them that always pops up. I don't think it's too bad, honestly, but people always point out how Wolverine looks like Nick Nolte here with the teeth. I don't disagree with that, but
well, and the one arm is like is ridiculously large. Like his left arm is enormous.
Yeah. I like how Wolverine looks on this. Actually, outside of maybe Sam Keith, I think that's actually one of my favorite. Well, just the Wolverine, of course. I love the image. I was going to say it was right up there, but I mean, Wolverine's been drawn by just about everyone, and I don't want to be held to a higher standard later on.
So here's. This book's kind of funny for me because I had such a different, I don't know, I had a different kind of reaction here. The art and stuff like that, and everything you said is true and it, you know, really cool and influenced. You can see the influences in the, it's badass. I definitely think so. And it's got a cool twist and all this stuff, but there's like close-ups on Wolverine's face, and I can't get past this. He's got these deep blue eyes, and I go back and I'm going, when the hell did he get blue eyes? And I look on the cover to Frank Miller's cover for Wolverine issue one, where he is with those brown eyes, and then I started researching, and somewhere when Hugh Jackman Wolverine became the new Wolverine, it switched to a blue-eyed Wolverine, and I never realized it. And I was so pissed over this one little factor that had nothing to do with the quality of the book. That is nothing. They're just doing what the Wolverine character is now, but they switched the color of his eyes, and I'm going, and I don't know, this is the fanboyish.
That is, yeah.
You gotta avoid.
Well, you don't even like Wolverine,
No, but
Wolverine. Why do you even?
But
care?
I love the. But I don't hate him. But I'm not a huge fan. Like I'm just take him or leave him. Like I don't hate him. But I love the Wolverine miniseries, the Miller Claremont Wolverine miniseries. That's great. And the cover is brown eyes. And I, so I keep on going. But his eyes are annoying. Like, the whole book, I'm going. I don't know what to tell you, Vic.
You were just distracted.
I was distracted by this. And by the fact that they made this, clearly they made sometime over the last 10, 15 years, they made this editorial decision to change this character's eye color. And I never realized it because I went started going back and reading some recent books with him on my Marvel Unlimited, you know. And I'm like, yeah, he's got blue eyes everywhere now.
That's funny.
I can see how this would bother you, though, because, I mean, there are a lot of direct eye shots in this. I mean, oh, yeah, they're just staring really each other blue. Down for the entire.
They're really blue,
and it's beautiful really, too, really blue. Because they've got shadows of, you know, the other characters in them, like the reflections of the other characters, and I mean that's fantastic. Like that's good detail work right there. You know, it's just thinking about those kind of things and the desire to put those in that. I really appreciate that kind of thing.
But there was nothing wrong with brown eyes.
Well, perhaps brown was less reflective in this case.
Well, you know, Wolverine's a female now in the current Marvel continuity, right?
So, Brett, let's move on to the next book.
Well, why don't we? Because we're running out of time for the show. So, why don't we touch a bit on both Batman Year One? I mean, we could do an entire podcast on Batman Year One.
Do it. We should do a series of podcasts on your
one. Yeah.
And I think maybe we will at some point. We'll get a bunch of people together and we'll talk year one because it's worth it in every sense.
So I've said it before on the air, Brett, and I'll say it again. In my opinion, it is the greatest Batman story ever told.
Yeah, I mean, it's undeniably brilliant and it set the tone for so much. But let's talk about David Mazzucchelli there, and let's talk about the Marvel Fanfare number 40 story, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah.
As well, like what a great little story this is. But, you know, David Mazzucchelli's work, I mean, it's just so sublime, and I love the fact that, you know, he's able to, especially in this number 40, like his style changes just enough to be kind of, you know, a little more Ditko-esque I guess, than it is in year one, where it's still a little, you know, it's a little meaner, it's a little more Batman-esque. But this has a nice Ditko feel to it, I find, and it gives you like a more upbeat tone.
Yeah, this is a great story. The art and the story, it's really heartfelt. I think this was his last work, possibly before he left to do Rubber Blankets. So this would have been his last Marvel DC stuff, I'm pretty sure. This stuff's just beautiful, though. I love the bold inks here, and then just the amount of cartooning he's doing here is perfect. It's not... And it's like directly against what is in the second half of this issue, which is what I consider to be kind of that typical comic art of the time, and similar to what you might see today even sometimes. But this stuff's just so cool.
Well, it's number one, Anna Sent is I think she's brilliant and big fan, and I would love to talk to her on the show. The story is great, but the thing that I love about that art is, like you say, like you have a character, this grandmother character, who's very cartoony. Very cartoony. And then you have the angel character who is literally looking like he's come out of some angelic painting from heaven. You know, like something you would see in a church almost. And totally different styles, but side by side and together, and they still fit. Like, I don't know how he managed to do this. It's just... It's an amazing piece of work.
I liked it as well. Although I have to admit, I was a little confused reading it. I did not know if this angel character, other than mentioning Mephisto, whether this was the X-Men's angel or not, whether this was continuity. What
did you read the first page, Chris? Because he talks about the very first page, the editorial. Al or whatever it was there, that one.
No, I didn't actually.
Kind of goes over that a little bit. It would have given you the background.
Yeah, because it's like taken from a specific fight from another comic.
Okay.
And then this is him falling to the ground. Actually, I really love, you know, when she's having all this self-doubt where she can't finish her... Actually, what's this? Yeah. I really love that. Yeah, she's just like so down on herself. The world is out to get her. The blender's going off dangerously. You know, she tries to go get that apple, and her neighbor stops her and is like, "You're too old." And everything's kind of pushing her to kind of give up on everything. And then she goes into the garage, and she kind of has this flashback when she's sitting in the car, but she's not driving it at this point because she's too scared. I love how they accomplish this flashback with like the overlapping image and the characters dancing. It's really, there's lots here to learn, from a storytelling aspect and, from a compositional aspect and just drawing straight up.
Well, and it's, the dialogue's minimalistic in many ways. There's not too many, there's just enough words for you to feel what the character's feeling and to know what the character's thinking and to understand the character. And it works in conjunction with the art so beautifully. Like, it was an awesome story. Absolutely. And of course, year one is the best Batman story ever told. So throw that out there.
Yeah, this one was cool because I feel like not many people have found this story, or it's not as well known. I was actually surprised you guys were able to track down the...
Brett's
I don't know,
genius of finding the stuff for us.
Well, it's because you know, like overall, like I wind up having a stash of like random things, and thankfully this occurred in my random things stash, so I was happy for that. But
that's great.
It's a perfect example, because one of the biggest things that I'm a fan of Marvel, especially of that time, was that every now and then you would come across a short story that was just an absolute gem. You know, where they brought in somebody, you know, some really excellent creators, and they just let them tell a good story. That it didn't necessarily, I mean, this one is, it fits nicely in continuity, but it's just the kind of story that that you don't normally see in a superhero book, but they're allowed to tell it in this case. And so those are the kind of things that I really appreciate and love to look for Marvel.
Marvel Fanfare was such an odd little book. I can't say I've ever read a bad issue, but it's forgotten for some reason, just because it doesn't really tie in anywhere.
Yeah, it's kind of like hit and miss for me. Even looking through like back issues, this is like before they labeled who was working on each issue, so it's always kind of annoying for me to be like, oh, this cover looks great, and you flip open, you're like, ah, it's okay. But this one I hunted out specifically. I didn't order it online. Found it at a con, surprisingly, but it was always one of my books to find eventually. So when I did, I was really stoked to find it.
And, you know, it's also, I think this Marvel Fanfare, at the same time they had Marvel Comics Presents going on. So I think that a lot of people got confused by kind of the two concepts at the same time.
Yeah, it's understandable. And, you know, in Marvel Comics Presents, of course, much more standard work in that regard. Now, that being said, I mean, Marvel Comics Presents has some brilliant stuff. I mean, Barry Windsor-Smith, Weapon X, of course. But, you know, there's good stories, but there's a lot of not so good stories that are involved in that too. And I think because you have to read over 6-8 issues of Marvel Comics Presents, where at least Marvel Fanfare was just about the short stories, and so I appreciated that a lot more. All right, well, I think we're coming, we're pretty much right up here on the end of our time.
I'd like 2 seconds to touch on Steel Glass. Vic, I have to thank you for this book. It was the one book that completely blew me away. The framing in a noir structure of this incredibly weird story, I just loved it. And I'm going to take one day on my vacation to read it someplace I can hear traffic. I was going to say on a bus, but oddly, and I almost jumped through the Skype line to choke you, Brett, when you mentioned that. I love this book. It's one of those books. It's been so long since I found a comic that just sort of blew my mind in this way, and just thank you. It's an absolute gorgeous, lovely book that, I mean, it touches on so many themes. I absolutely love City of Glass.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites too. So I'm really glad you enjoyed it. I guess the most proper the proper place to read this would be like Grand Central Station in New York or something like that. But yeah, it's a cool book, and the ending, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody that hasn't read it, because I think this is like one of those books that everybody should read. But I love how Paul Auster, who this is adapted material of his book, City of Glass.
You know, I think a lot of people aren't going to get it. It's not a book I'm going to be handing out to unless I really know you.
Yeah. You know,
because it is weird.
Yeah. This put me on a long journey of I was already a fan of Mazzucchelli, and that's the reason I read this, but I hadn't read
it. It's completely different than anything. I mean, even the art, I think, is quite different than anything I've ever seen him do.
Yeah, the story, I feel he took some influence from the story when he did Asterios Polyp, maybe. But Paul Auster, I would recommend almost all of his books if you're interested in this type of story. His books are fantastic, and I think my shelf, I have like a ton of his books on my shelf, but one that I would recommend especially would be Mr. Vertigo. So good. I actually
that isn't on my to buy list, because the afterword did list that's the next book in the or the next Paul Auster book.
It's
now, is
book.
It graphic as well, or
no? It's just the book, but there is there might be
just a book isn't a derogatory though. It's a book. That's okay. I just
no, but in a conversation where we're talking about comics, it's just a book. It's not a comic book. But there may be some pages floating around that somebody did for that book, as part of a pitch.
And maybe that person might want to forward them just to
maybe. Other I did a
curious as hell.
I did a pitch for that book and sent it off to
what? It's you?
To his manager, and then she sent it to him. Then he got back to me. It was a no go, but it was still a fun experience. And it was, I love that book so much. So I would highly recommend if you're looking for, I don't know, something good to read, Paul Auster's Mr. Vertigo. It's a great book.
And since you mentioned it, you know, we need to give some love to Asterius Polyp, which is amazing. That was mind blowing when I read that. That's been brought up by a couple of different people on the show, and so I went out and I had to find it because of that. And you know, like, my jaw was, you know, on the floor after reading that.
Yeah, that's a fantastic book, too.
All right, well, thanks a lot, Vic. And we're definitely going to have you back on again, because obviously I forgot the Hellboy book, so we have to do this again. And it was a lot of fun. And so, all right, Mo, you were saying that you had something for Vic, and Chris has something for Vic, and I have something for Vic. So, Mo, why don't you jump in?
Yeah, just kind of before the podcast, I mean, we were mentioning that we were going to, talk about the books that Vic had recommended, and I thought there was a book that I really wanted to recommend to you that I'd love to bring you back to talk about, and then the other guys jumped in with something as well. So you're going to come back and talk to us about the books, and we'll read Hellboy. You'll read these. And we'll talk about four more books.
That's right. I think that's a cool idea.
And I think you're going to really like this, because this to me was a book that when I read 100%, there was some level of that slice of life feeling of it just, you know, everybody has an interesting story and just being comfortable telling that story. And it's called Zampu. I don't know what it's called. Zampu. X-A-M-P-U. Lovely Losers. It's by Roger Cruz, who's done Hulk and X-Men and X-Men Plus and Spider-Man.
I remember his work, yeah.
Yeah, Brazilian artist. He did this, came out, probably about 2-3 years ago. So it's fairly new. I read it digitally on Comixology. You can read it that way. If you can't, that was an easy way to get a translated version. And I think his art here is completely different than it was in if you're familiar with his Marvel work, and very different style, but just really wonderful characterization. I think you'll really like it. So I would love to get your opinion on that book.
Sure. Yeah, I will track it down. I'm going to look for a physical copy, but if I can't find it, I'll go digital. But yeah, I remember his work. He was kind of criticized as like a Joe Mad ripoff kind of guy.
Yeah, that's right.
But I had seen his work after that online, maybe over like maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and it was completely different. More energy and maybe cartoony or something like that. But it looks really cool.
In a lot of ways, when you read this, this will harken back to kind of those, you know, late 60s, early 70s kind of underground comics, and that it has a feel like that art wise and kind of storyline wise, that kind of underground comic feel of that you would kind of associate with, you know, San Francisco and, you know, that type of area, so I think I really can't wait to hear what you think about it.
I will track it down. Sounds interesting.
All right, Chris, what's yours?
All right, I can't narrow it down, so I got two. Number one, if you like Paul Pope, I think you're going to love Ted McKeever. I'd suggest Mondo. I think it's the most accessible of his work. Well, it is.
That's funny. Oh, yeah.
Considering I have no idea what happens in it, but it involves chicken mutants.
I mean, I might have suggested Metropole, you know.
Metropole's, I mean, it's all good. I mean, if it's Ted McKeever, it's good.
It is good. I mean,
so Mondo or Metropole, or should you guys choose one?
Doesn't matter if it says Ted McKeever on it. Read it. That's
okay. Will do. I haven't, I don't think I've read anything from Ted McKeever.
Mondo's a kick in the ass, and nothing like Paul Pope.
That's
no, the art style. It's the art style. It's not a. Okay. I think of Paul Pope as kind of weird, and Ted McKeever's way out there.
Well, that's no doubt about that. What's your other one?
My other one is just one of my favorite books. I've been kicked out of shopping malls for trying to just pass this one out to people. I don't know if you're familiar with Kyle Baker, but yeah, Why I Hate Kyle Saturn.
Baker. I Why haven't I read Saturn. That one. I will read it, though.
It's absolutely sublime.
Why I Hate Saturn? Chris just recommended to you the best thing I've ever read, ever.
Really?
That is my best movie, best book, best comic, best anything. For me, it's Why I Hate Saturn.
Wow.
And it's an awesome, that and Zampu together would be a great combo. So that's an awesome choice, Chris. And if you like that, I got another Kyle Baker for you some other time.
Sure. I'll start here. I've read, a little bit of Kyle Baker stuff, and I've obviously seen his art on, some of the comic stuff you've done over the years.
Yeah, this is probably what, late 80s, do you think, Brett, that first came out?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yes, he's done a lot of different types of work, and this is, especially for us. I mean, it is the most accessible, I found, but it is absolutely perfect in its regard.
That or You Are Here, I would say, are the two most accessible.
Yes. Now, for me, I'm going to go with an Image comic. I'm going to go with The Bulletproof Coffin, specifically Disinterred, the second miniseries. The first miniseries is fantastic, but it's David Hein and Shaky Kane. And Shaky Kane's art, he's one of my favorite artists because he's just different. Everything's different. And I picked up a book called Monster Truck at the last Calgary Expo, and it's unbelievably weird, but great. But I first got introduced with The Bulletproof Coffin. I was doing reviews, and I was just picking random books, and this happened to be one of them, and it just blew my mind. So,
is it Mondo weird?
It's in its own way, yeah. Like, there's no chickens, but it's weird.
I'm just checking. We like Vic, don't we? Because, I mean, there may be no path back from this reading list.
Oh, come on. Given all of the stuff that we read, a lot of this stuff, I actually believe that it fits nicely into that world. We're all engaged, entering this twilight zone of comics together.
I'll check that out. I have a recollection of the Bulletproof Coffin, and I never read it, but I might have been looking at it on the stands here and there. But Shaky Kane's work I'm familiar with. Yeah, it's definitely different. I think he did a cover for, I don't know, an anthology, one of the first things I did years ago, and I think he did the cover for it. But I'll check it out. These are very interesting picks. So, I'll read them and let you. I haven't read any of these books.
What do most people recommend to you? These are interesting picks. What's a not interesting pick people recommend to you?
I don't know. Usually, recommendations are fairly straightforward these days. Like, you run into somebody like a fan or another creator, and it's usually something that's heavily influenced them, but that you probably already read. If I go and recommend a book to somebody, I probably wouldn't recommend Batman Year One because I know everybody has read that. But it's up there. It's great. But I don't know. I haven't really gotten any. I guess. Oh yeah, I have something here. I hadn't read, and I still haven't read Superman for All Seasons, by Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale, and that was recommended to me. When was that? At the Edmonton convention, so a few months ago. So I bought it. I haven't read it yet, but I have it here to read. So. I don't know. It's
an interesting one. Keith actually said, I think Keith once told me that when he read that, he actually cried Like they like it. You know, it's a good book, real good.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I like Tim.
Not as good as any of the ones we recommended, but
that one seems more straightforward in a way than the ones that you have recommended. But
yes,
I know that.
We're working off your list, though.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just a response to some of the books that I gave. So I'm curious to read these to see. I don't know if I enjoy them. I'm pretty sure I probably will. So yeah, we should definitely do another one of these to chat about those books, and then
the Secret Santa story exchange with
that's right. It kind of is.
And we used to have this gimmick where we would go on and recommend a story, and we'd have a guy who would mute out the or like give away the story, say you're supposed to read this, and then they would try and guess who it was that recommended it on the podcast, and we got kind of away from it, but it was a cool idea. So this is kind of along those lines. So,
all right. Well, Mo, what do you say we wrap this one up?
Before we go VOUT, this is your last chance here. We have a little thing we do on the podcast, and in all seriousness, we want to say thank you, and for this, we're going to give you this chance. It's a little segment we're going to end it with here for you, just for you. We like to call it Plug Your Shit.
Okay. Well, the current project I'm working on is called Jim Thompson's The Killer Inside Me. It's published by IDW. It's an adaptation of the 1952 novel of the same name. And it's not for everybody. And that's not a good sales tactic, but it's true. And I don't want people to read it and get mad at me. It's some touchy and sensitive material, but it's a pretty cool cult classic novel, and I feel like our adaptation's pretty good. There's been some movie adaptations of this over the years, at least two that I know of, one that was pretty recent, but I think a comic book is going to be more successful than the movie version, but we'll never do better than the source material. But yeah, the third issue is coming out in November tomorrow, but this might be up after that. And it's a 5-issue miniseries.
That's a guarantee.
Yeah. Bolton, it's a 5-issue miniseries that your book will be out tomorrow and that our podcast will be out after tomorrow. Yes, all of those things, a guarantee.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. This is a blast, Vic. Thanks so much for being on.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.